drugs,
rape, quality of life,
recovery, harm reduction,
advocacy,
policy, treatment,
stigma.
Drugs Uncut, the Scottish Drugs Forum podcast.
Hello and welcome to Scottish Drugs Forum's podcast, Drugs Uncut, about all things drugs. For today's podcast, we were joined by special guests, our colleagues Jason Wallace, Louise Aitken and Wes Steele, who were speaking to Arond Knutsen. Arond is the leader of Forungen for Women, Narkotapolitik, which is my Norwegian for the Association for Humane Drug Policy in Norway, which is an organisation of people with living experience which seeks to influence policy and practice in Norway.
My name's Jason Wallace. I work with the Scottish Drugs Forum. I'm Senior Development Officer. Been there for a long while. At the moment, I currently manage a living experience engagement team. But prior to that, I managed a volunteering and peer research team and the naloxone peer education programme.
Thanks. My name is Louise Aitken. I'm a Peer Research Development Officer with the Scottish Drugs Forum, and my role is I work with volunteers who have lived and living experience, and I've been working there now for 3 years, next month, yeah.
My name is Wes Steele. I work primarily on peer-to-peer naloxone supply across Scotland. I've been with the Scottish Drugs Forum about 2.5 years, and it's a privilege to be here.
Thank you. My name is Aril Knudsen. I come from Norway. I'm leader of the Association for Humane Drug Policy, which is a drug user organization. So I'm a drug user representative.
That's brilliant. Thank you very much for making time and coming along and participating in the podcast. So we've just got a few themes, Aril, if that's okay, and we'll just kind of ask you to explore or give a bit of a description about some of these themes, and then we're just going to have an informal conversation about them, if everybody's happy with that. So first off, just initially, how did you become involved in drug activism in Norway? And if you could just give us a brief bit of a background of how you became involved and what that kind of looked like.
Yeah, I had severe drug problems when I was a teenager in the 80s. I went into drug treatment in 1990, 1991, 1992, 93, 94. And then I got into, you know, political and society issues. I was more and more engaged in political issues and in lifestance issues, religion, lifestance, racism, all those kinds of issues. And then I got into environments where people had some kind of attitudes about what's right and what's wrong, and there was always one issue that was puzzling to me, and that is how people react to drug use and their attitudes to drug users. So I wanted to participate in the debate. And then one day, I think it was in early 2000, I saw an article about Ninni Stoltenberg, and she is the sister, she was, unfortunately, the sister of Jens Stoltenberg, the Secretary General of NATO. She had had serious drug problems, and she was very open about it. And she had engaged in a drug policy organization that did not have this against drugs, against drug use way to... It was just about drug policy. So I contacted her, and she was very receivable, and we got to know each other and started to work in drug policy in early 2000. Yeah. There were some drug user organizations, but they were part of the temperance movement. So you had to be a former drug user with a turning point history from when they succeeded in drug treatment. So the ultimate goal was to stop using drugs and have quite hard attitudes to what all the wrongs you had done, at least about using drugs. So we found out very early that we needed more drug user organizations, because at that time, that was when the harm reduction started. We got a big debate about the drug consumption rooms. And then that these organizations said, no, as a former drug addict, you should not, this is just helping people use drugs and all those kind of attitudes. So therefore we needed a real drug user organization where you see people as resources, whether you use drugs or whether you don't use drugs or whether you have drug problems. You're still a resource. You have this very important drug user perspective.
Can I just ask, did you find many people who were former drug users still wanted to align and kind of join and participate in the activism that you were a part of? Or was it very much kind of siloed? People that had a historical problem would err on the more side of the temperance movement and people currently using. Or was there a lot of overlap? Were there people that were kind of in both groups, so to speak?
Yeah, but that did not have an organization representing them.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah. So I think that's one of the challenges we have in Scotland, Harold, is we have many organizations who claim to be drug user organizations, but actually it's more of a harm reduction organization with drug users working or volunteering in it. It isn't a top-down drug user organisation. But as Wes was alluding to there, one of the bigger challenges we have, which we'll come on to discuss in Scotland, is we have abstinence versus harm reduction. So people who have a history of using drugs who are now abstinent will have some of the same views that you mentioned there. You should not be promoting supervised consumption or heroin assist. This is, people need to stop completely. So this is where we're currently at in Scotland at the moment. You have harm reduction versus abstinence, which is really challenging in terms for government to have policy that is sort of suitable and amenable to both sides.
I take pride in one thing, that I never oppose, you know, NAAA groups. I never oppose organizations that's for total abstinence.
Yeah.
I never oppose those with turning point histories or abstinence only. Yeah. You know, I'm not a part of it, but I never oppose it. So you have to work together with those attitudes so they don't oppose what we have, because we have evidence on what works and what doesn't work. And of course, drug users are very different. So if I would oppose drug treatment or oppose a place where abstinence is the solution, well, some drug users, they have that kind of attitude and they need that kind of attitude to get rid of their problems.
Yeah.
So that is so important to meet those people and discuss that. Why do you oppose drug consumption? We have evidence drug consumption rooms saves lives. Yeah. You cannot oppose that. But of course, we need this and we also need that. I think that kind of attitude is so important. So therefore, it's very good that you can, if you could have a conference like tomorrow and forums where we discuss this with the police and with the organizations and everything.
Yeah. Mm. I think for the Scottish Drugs Forum, what we try to advocate is we need people to have choice. So abstinence should always be an option for people, but we need heroin assisted treatment. We need proper substitution treatment. We need residential treatment. People need to have a choice. Personally, I choose to be abstinent in my life, but that doesn't mean that works for everyone. Mm. So in my working life, I promote choice to people.
Yeah, good. And when we come together and have tolerance for each other's views and all kind of measures that we need, then the politicians find us more interesting, because then it's a very hard debate. I have a lot of people in my organization that cannot go out in the media and promote their view because they will get problems with their school, with their family, with the police, with their job, with everything, because it's so stigmatized, not just to be a drug user or drug user representative, but to promote decriminalization and harm reduction. So therefore, it's an issue that a lot of politicians don't want to touch into, because they will be badly hurt from one side or the other, and therefore we get a very few resources, and that's the main problem, that it's not funded enough.
Just on that, do you find it's often yourself that is encouraged then to take part in any of the kind of strategy or the parliamentary or the public speaking or any media stuff kind of for the organization, or are other people encouraged to kind of come forward as well and kind of participate in that stuff too? Or are you kind of the, for want of a better phrase, the go-to person for media inquiries or participating in parliament?
I'm one of them, and in my organization, it's very much me, but there's others too, so I lift up other voices too. But we are a lot of organizations in Norway, and we are very visible. So the biggest news media, they contact us when it is something. But we're always like, this is a dynamic. There's always a dynamic situation. So we always bring the journalists out in the streets. We have open drug scenes in the biggest cities in Norway. So we always bring them there to talk with those. And we can, look into who are in a situation where they can take that suggestion if they want to go to media. And also we bring every year active people with problematic drug use into the parliament. So we call it Drug Users Day. And so every year we get one party at the parliament to invite us in and to invite all the other parties so that we can bring up our issues. And we do that democratically. So it's not just me thinking on behalf of the drug users, we should discuss this and that. We do it like community work.
I'd be interested to ask just on that, if people from the community get any support or training before attending any of these types of events. I know in Scotland we struggle sometimes, or something I see, I guess, in practice often, is people from the ADP level, which is the Alcohol Drugs Partnership, the kind of statutory body governing delivery of services in an area, want to include people who lived and live and experience in strategy meetings. I don't always think they necessarily get much training or the background before they're invited to attend such things. And I think that can put people out of their depth sometimes. I myself even can sometimes at strategy meetings feel a wee bit out of my depth. I've been working in the field for several years, so I just try and put myself in the shoes of the person that might be invited, that's, it's a new world to them. So I'd just be interested to ask if there is anything that happens for the people kind of before they go or invited to parliament.
No, not enough. But they do a great work when they come. They have resources like anyone else. And then you get from the message from, their heart. And so I don't put them into a strategic way of working, but we should do it more. But the important thing is that there are a lot of people that are considered drug user representatives because they provide something. They work in some services, but then they have to be loyal to where they work. In a drug user organization, they are just loyal to they and their own community. So this is why they can be representing themselves and not something else.
I think this is an area that we possibly struggle with in Scotland a wee bit. I don't know if anyone wants to chime in on that and just we do have lots of staff in peer roles in different services, and they are again often invited to strategy meetings or development days that an area might be holding. And I think it must be tough. I know I found it tough myself in the past to kind of figure out which hat I might be wearing at an event.
Yeah,
definitely. So the reason we struggle is because when we look to choose people who have lived experience, we look to the workforce, because the individuals are easier to manage. So the individuals we work with on a daily basis, we have living experience, who are still actively injecting heroin, smoking crack, they tend not to be invited to these meetings because, oh, having somebody using drugs coming into your building. What if they use drugs in my building? What if they overdose? What if they get aggressive and angry? And so there's a real fear of having individuals actively using drugs involved in the discussions. We have some areas in Scotland who actively do that, but that is, we usually attend these meetings and provide support to the individual. Almost what we're saying is we'll attend the meetings and we'll take care of the management of the individual. Because otherwise you wouldn't invite them. What about your anus?
Can I just add one thing? I think it's a myth behind that they don't want to speak to active drug users, because in all environments in our society, even in Parliament, there are active drug users.
Yeah. Yeah.
So more people should come out of the closet, because, you know, we had this stigmatizing picture of drug users as dirty, as living on the street, injecting water from a pool. Like, but drug use is in all kind of environments in the society.
Yeah, definitely. Totally agree. And tomorrow at the conference, that's one of my opening slides. Us and them.
Yeah.
And there's a wee list of the drugs that us, the people that think they're using clean drugs, use, and there's a wee list of the drugs that people see as been dirty. And this is the issue that in Scotland, if in most organisations, if you were to openly come out and say, I snort cocaine, I smoke crack, take heroin, you would probably lose your job.
Yeah, and if you're into politics, the worst drug you can use is alcohol.
Yes.
Because it makes you not more intelligent.
Yes.
Intelligent.
Yeah. I mean, like, when you started, you were speaking about how you get involved in this kind of line of work was a lot to do with people's attitudes and things like that. And then when you were speaking there yourself, Jason, and speaking about supporting peers with living experience along these kind of meetings and like with ADPs and government politicians. I've supported some peers along to these meetings, and that you were talking about was, you know, the support and the training that's, is there any provided for them? It's quite daunting. You know, I've had peers come and say, like, to go to this meeting and I feel really anxious, and like, because it's like official people that are going to be there, and what do they want to listen to me for? And I think it's massive just for them to be part of that and to feel that they're being heard and to feel that they're being supported, and that their voice does matter, and sharing that wee bit of their experience. I always encourage them not to share too much, because what they kind of put out there, they can never really take back, and to protect themselves at all costs. Especially when they're kind of speaking in big groups of people or on a platform, or they're putting it out there on kind of social media, unless they feel absolutely comfortable with doing that. I think it's huge. I'm going off track with the themes here, but I was saying to Jason and Wes this morning when we met about, I read your article, and like one of the things that stuck out for me was that people who use substances suffer for a lack of respect and human dignity. And I think that's, and that's what you kind of started with this morning. Do you know, I think that's the way it's kind of drug users are viewed in Scotland. And I think the more that ourselves and everybody else that works in this field, people who use drugs, who have had experience of using drugs, speak about things like this topics, it helps to kind of hopefully break down some barriers and stigma for people.
I think there's two groups that very many among them die too early. It's young lads, boys, because it's very hard for young men to speak about feelings and so on. So communication to be understood and to find a role and have a future. And so therefore, very many young men take their lives? And why do we have so many overdoses? Because this is a group that that doesn't feel respected. They don't have dignity in life. They don't feel understood. They don't feel people can understand them, and that they, so they cannot either not communicate their issues, and a lot of people among them die. I think it's a similar kind of situation when you are they're stigmatized, marginalized. There's no other group that we would tolerate that live under such circumstances, mm-hmm. that people with problematic drug use. No other group would we tolerate that. So they're treated as not as equal, and they don't have their human rights. They have nothing like that, and they don't have protection of the law, because in all stories about oppression and human rights violation, police control instead of police protection is at the center of these stories. Yeah. So, yeah.
Definitely. So, just to pick up on a few points you made there. So, in Scotland, we talk a lot about stigma, but actually, what it is we see is discrimination, but we don't call it discrimination, because if you call it discrimination, there's a protected characteristic within the law for that. Mm. So we call it stigma, but it's actually discrimination. And when you were mentioning the human rights there, I've been involved we have a national collaborative in Scotland, which is part of the national mission. And our task in the collaborative is we're called the change team. So we're currently in the process of writing a charter of human rights, which will accompany the new Scottish Bill of Human Rights in 2025, mm-hmm. which will recognise the rights of individuals with substance misuse problems. So individuals will then have that protection of the law. There'll be that legislation underpinning it where if individuals are not getting the service that they feel they're entitled to, then they will be able to take that service to court. They will be able to raise action through the judicial system against that service, which is a really good, positive move in the right direction. However, I think we need to be mindful that certainly in Scotland, because you have rights, does not mean you will get the rights upheld.
No.
So in Glasgow City at the moment, if you are homeless, you're protected by legislation, the law. But just a few months ago, Glasgow City Council came out and openly said they had breached that legislation more than 2,000 times. By not providing people who are homeless with suitable accommodation. So it's worth remembering that even you have rights protected within the law, it doesn't always mean they will be upheld. However, the Charter of Human Rights for the National Collaborative, I'm hopeful that if some of these services have an action raised against them, that will start to change how we deliver services in Scotland.
Mm.
But there is positive moves in the right direction.
Yes, I think it's an important move. And I don't know if I can manage to speak about this in English, but certainly not in Scottish, but it's very hard also to categorize a group as drug users so that they can have their rights, because there are some kind of laws for other kind of groups that they don't want to be considered a part of.
Yeah.
So that's the best way I can put it. But even though it's very important to look into it, because our National Institute for Human Rights have now released a report in Norway and looking into the human rights situation surrounding drug use. And they find that they are not protected by the law. and they are not proportionately reacted from the police and in the healthcare system. That it is problematic that they're forced to deliver urine samples and to come so and so often to deliver their medication because there's no evidence behind it. It's just attitudes behind these kind of measures. And then and they also found that, you know, people with drug problems are victims of a lot of crime, like hatred, threatenings, violence, sexual harassment, and even worse. And they are not protected. There are nowhere they can go to be protected. So if a wife is suffering violence from her husband, she can be go somewhere and be protected. But people with problematic drug use has nowhere to go to be protected. And that's an awful kind of human rights violation.
I think something that occurs to me when you were talking about kind of stigma, and we've been speaking about discrimination, is in Scotland I often hear the phrase hard to reach. And people trying to access support services, particularly prescribing services maybe, are often defined as hard to reach. I would, I guess, argue that people are not hard to reach. They're usually pretty easy to find if you reach out to them in the right way and in the right manner. I'd just be interested to hear if, you know, if there is such kind of terminology used in Norway, or if people in need of support and prescribing can access services quite easily. I think in Scotland, one of the reasons we've got so few people in treatment is because services aren't always easy to navigate and referral pathways aren't always accessible to the people that often need them the most. So I'd just be interested, any thoughts you've got on that?
Very interesting, and I support what you're saying. Yes, in Norway, they use the term hard to reach and hard to treat. And of course, it's because they don't have nothing to that they need right now. And also the stigmatizing attitudes where they look upon drug users as criminal beings, you don't feel understood. You're not met like the person you are, and that you have those and those needs. So when they have made their services, it's what they want to provide us, not what we really need. So therefore, they use these terms, hard to reach and hard to treat.
Yeah, that's interesting, because in Scotland, we see these issues as being sitting under a health model. However, prior to that, they sat under justice.
Mm-hmm.
And as much as now they are under health, they are still delivered as if they sat under justice. So we don't really see we talk about having a public health emergency and stuff like that in Scotland, but we don't see the resource for a public health emergency going into this. We still see, you mentioned it earlier, we still see very little funding going into it, and the funding that does make its way to harm reduction type organisations is usually based on 1 year, sometime 2 years funding. So if you have a public health emergency, it's hard to actually have a plan of action over 3, 4, 5, 10 years if you only have funding for 1 year, sometimes 2 years. So that's one of the challenges that we have in Scotland. It currently sits under the health portfolio, but it doesn't always feel like it's a health approach we're having to these issues.
I think the problem with harm the attitudes towards harm reduction is it's still a criminal issue, and we are looked upon as criminal people. So so the health services are always in not very smart way narrowed. Because you must create an attitude that you must not go too far in helping those that the overall politics is to punish. So I understood that quite early, because when I started this organization, Association for Humane Drug Policy, we started outreach work. And because we saw that people could get the syringes and pumps, you know, and nothing more. And so they needed citric acid. So they went to the store and found the too strong, and they used dirty water and they boiled it up in dirty stuff and like that. So we started to hand out ascorbic acid because that's harm reduction and that's pain reduction. So the veins come back and it's more easily to inject and your teeth don't fall out that easy and many other stuff. And after a while, I had ascorbic acid, stearin cups, sterile salt water, and so on. And then they went to the municipalities and, why don't you hand out the things that he's doing? Oh, I think that's going too far in the direction of decriminalization or legalizing. It's looked upon as kind of liberal, idiot liberal attitudes. So you must not go too far. Therefore, we have this, when people suggest to go further, more medication treatment, drug consumption room, you have these big, large debates for years up to the government and for at least 5 years before anything happens. And that is because it's a kind of moralistic issue. And it's so stupid because we have evidence that it really works. Yeah. The health-centered approach brings evidence to what works and what doesn't. And harm reduction, substitution treatment, more medication that you can control more and be more listened to. We know it saves lives. We know it's best for the society. We know it's very smart to use money on it. That, you know, it's a better everything. Yeah. It's a win-win. But even though we get this, because we're still, it's still a criminal and moral issue that makes people have some strange attitudes towards.
Yeah, very interesting, because we often speak in Scotland about delivering evidence-based harm reduction.
Mm.
But what you just described there is almost like when you present the evidence, it moves away from the evidence-based harm reduction and becomes a moralistic discussion.
Yeah.
And that's what becomes a problem. Mm. And that's exactly what we experience in Scotland, and I would even say the whole of the UK at the moment. There is good, strong evidence for all around the world that these interventions work, and in the long term they will save money. However, like you say, we've been discussing supervised consumption rooms for several years. We have a very small pilot of the heroin-assisted treatment in Glasgow, which is very small and is a model that possibly couldn't be replicated across Scotland because it's a very expensive model that was built to deliver. So it's interesting when you say that it moves to having almost a moralistic discussion about what's right and wrong. Is it because it's still seen as criminal behaviour?
And you in Scotland really need those kind of services. I've seen what this great guy, Peter Kraken, has done. We have had a drug consumption room in Oslo since 2005, and it works so well. Almost every day there is an overdose where they save their life.
Yeah.
But it's too small still, but... And it was so controversial when that arrived in 2005.
Yeah.
But now it's so popular. So we have had this big discussion because first it was heroin injection site. It was only for heroin and you could only inject. And like 10 years ago, we had this big discussion about changing the law. And then we got it after 5 years or something like 8 years, actually. So now we have changed the law so that every problematic drug use, every kind of substance like amphetamine, benzodiazepines, anything, coke, you can use there, and you don't have to inject. And so now we are looking for a place to open drug consumption room number 2 in Oslo. We have got a new one in Bergen, and we will also get one in Trondheim in the middle of Norway. And that shows that when you get this up and see how how it reduces harm and saves lives, then we get more and more and more because it's smart. But of course, heroin-assisted treatment is, in a way, even better. We have had this discussion for like 20 years, and now we received it from last year, and some of my opponents for many years have been inside that clinic, seeing 40, 50 people coming to get their legal heroin, and they've been crying in front of me, really tears, because they've seen what they've done, because they have seen the same kind of people trying. They've been hard to treat. methadone, trying buprenorphine, trying abstinence, institutionalized them, putting them out and in of jail, and they've been sicker and sicker, and there's nothing going for them. And then they come into the heroin clinic, and everyone has gone to repair their teeth. Everyone has come, I need a real place to live, I need a work. So a lot of them has gone off to work because they function. Finally, they can function like everyone else, and they really do. So heroin-assisted treatment, it should be many, many more. Yeah. But now we have also seen that those with buprenorphine and methadone, there's a lot of people with opiate addiction that does not work very well on methadone and buprenorphine. And because of the evidence from Switzerland and so on, it's very narrow, the heroin clinics. You have to come in, you have to take it under supervision, and you have to be observed for 20 minutes, and then you can come back later in the day. So that has created, and now we see that in Norway. There's a gap between those on methadone, buprenorphine, and those on legal heroin. And I have to say, when legal heroin is the answer for quite a few people, then what was the problem? It was not the heroin. It was the solution for a lot of people. So this, it brings something to consider. But this gap between the diamorphine, methadone, buprenorphine, we are trying to fill that in Norway now. So now we will also start with short-acting morphine and long-acting morphine, the kind of morphine that works for 24 hours. There's a kind of few thousand people that will profit very well on those medication that does not profit on methadone or buprenorphine.
Yeah, excellent. One of the issues we have in Scotland when we discuss supervised consumption rooms is people always say, well, how would the local community respond to it if you had a supervised consumption room? Drug dealers will just sell drugs outside it. There'll be more crime. There'll be all of that. What's your experience of having that early consumption room in Oslo? How did the community respond to it? Was there increasing drug dealing, crime, that such?
No, it was the thing that was increasing was the contact with health workers, the better hygiene, the better. So, the life savings. And when they meet them, the health workers and social workers meet them every day, they can see when it's going wrong towards an overdose. Because when people really have a bad time, they don't care. You really find out they don't care. They inject too much. They puncture their veins, and I don't remember the word for it, but
ambivalent.
Ambivalent.
They don't care if they live or die.
True. So they can see that a kind of a week before, but outside, it's the opposite, because even though you will find the people when they are motivated to do something about their life and to intervene in a positive way. So it's not drug sellers outside the drug consumption room or something like that. That's a myth.
This is a subject that I find quite close to my heart, because I'm a person who used to use and inject away from home in open spaces quite a lot. And just very recently, I was actually in Glasgow and I was helping somebody who was in an overdose state in an alleyway, and it stunk of urine. There was human feces right there. And just a young person, just a young lady. And I just think that there is a clear need for this. One of my frustrations around it, if I'm honest, is a lot of voices in the abstinent community will come out and speak against drug consumption rooms, or they will question the feasibility or that people would use them. And I just think of, you know, my own personal experience of injecting in similar places, I most certainly would have attended a safe and clean hygienic space, and it probably would have increased my, you know, contact with healthcare. And I just think showing that concern for a population, showing that concern that society does care. And I think, you know, my worry is if and when it does happen, it will be a very small pilot. And it comes back, I think, to that topic about evidence. You know, if evidence is found that aligns with the ideology of the people in the power, then how quickly I think they would follow it. When it doesn't align with that ideology that's already there, how they then want another pilot or another trial. They want more evidence. You know, I've heard recently or read recently that people question, would it work in a Scottish context? And I just think that's ludicrous to me. I think that's just ludicrous.
Yeah, it's crazy. And when I'm having these discussions, I often make the argument that actually in the whole of the UK, we've had supervised consumption facilities for a long, long time. They're called public houses, and the drug gets consumed as alcohol. But the difference is that's a legal drug, and it's taxable, and it's socially acceptable for people. So when we already have that, but we have massive opposition to supervised drug consumption rooms for this population, it goes back to what you mentioned earlier there, Harold. It does start to become a moralistic discussion on what we feel is right and wrong as a society.
We have had this kind of discussion in Norway too with the heroin assisted treatment. We must remember we are Norwegian and we are not Swiss. And when the drug consumption room back in the days, we are not from Netherlands. We're not that kind of liberal people. It's stupid to think that a drug addict will come to these kind of facilities and care about their own health. And they were wrong. So the gentlemen and ladies that you talk about, I would very much like to receive them at the drug consumption room in Norway, because they are very they invite us in, and there are so fantastic health and social workers at that site who would receive them as their personal guests.
So I guess I would be interested to know then, see, like, for you, the kind of drug consumption rooms and that you have, like, what was, like you were talking about at the start, like the kind of attitudes and that of people towards drug users, what was the kind of turning point for change towards their kind of attitudes towards the consumption rooms?
It was evidence from Europe, but also it was this at this time when they started to ask people, the drug users, representatives. And Nini Stoltenberg, as I mentioned earlier, she was asked a lot of questions about that time, but didn't have an organization. And then it was this drug user organization connected to the temperance movement, and they were much, much stronger. But it was an attitude that, you know, was developing then, but not too much, because the politics has been since been contradictory. Because you criminalize, you punish, you exclude on one side, and you give them health care and include them and include, and so on the other side. So that was kind of puzzling to us. And I think what really changed the attitudes in Norway was the overdose work, because when we suggested, it was around 10 years ago, we suggested to hand out naloxone, the opiate antidote, and to have a switch campaign, which is very successful, believe it or not, because many people won't believe it, but a switch campaign where we inspire people to switch from injecting to smoking. I mean, the attitudes have changed so much because of that, because the police 10 years ago, they come running after us, threw us down, could break our arm and open our jaws just in case we were in possession of drugs. Now they come running after us with this nasal spray in case we are about to die. And that kind of, you know, and switch campaign. Okay, you're going to use heroin, but because Naloxone, it treats an overdose that has already occurred. But when people switch from injecting to smoking, you prevent those overdoses. So that's even more important in my view. And then people are meeting around all over Norway because we have this national overdose strategy. So even the conservative people out in the country must come in and learn that, okay, if some of your citizens in your municipality is going to use heroin, and we know they do, you must get in touch with them and have a peer-to-peer switch campaign where you say, okay, but can you please try to smoke the heroin instead of injecting? And there was this minister and this conservative politician that I have been discussing with. We were always on the different side of the table in all kind of discussions, but he's a great guy, great politician, but we didn't agree. And he became the Minister of Health when the parliament majority said we should have this national overdose strategy. So, and then he was in some kind of trouble because one of the first tasks he had as minister was to go around in Norway and to teach people about this overdose strategy. And it's very important to have naloxone and to have this sweet. Aril, can you come up and explain what on earth is this? Mm. So then he have to travel around with me. And then we were on the same side of the table, and all the municipalities had to meet, all the biggest municipalities and all those with the most overdoses were forced by the health authorities in Norway to come together and discuss. So then we got, suddenly we had 50, 60 harm reduction services in communities that we never had it before. And then this, so that brought a real change in attitudes. And I think that was what led up to that in 3 years later in 2016, we wrote a petition in Norway's biggest newspaper where we demanded, it was called Nothing About Us Without Us. We demanded to be listened to, that human rights must form the basis of all drug policies, and that you should stop criminalizing us and without punishment being replaced by new intrusive sanctions. And it was signed by 90 public figures, academics, lawyers, politicians, party leaders even. And Bent Høie, the conservative minister of health, he said that later said that was the turning point for him. And I think it was the harm reduction and the overdose prevention efforts that really made him reconsider and look into the findings. So that was why he in 2019, I think, put down this drug reform committee. They looked into all the findings in the world. And in 2019, I think, they presented their work, and there's no evidence that criminalization prevents drug use, but it creates stigma, it creates crime, it creates most of the elements in what we call drug problems. And therefore, the conservative government in 2021 suggested a drug reform with decriminalization. And that discussion has made even more changes in attitudes in Norway. We have a snowball effect. We have this massive ongoing change in Norway that is really interesting in the court system, in the health system, in the population. Mm.
Excellent.
Really interesting.
That's definitely somewhere we would like to get to. In Scotland, and it sounds like a great exercise for MD for the Scottish Government who listens to this podcast is maybe part of the cross-party group on drugs, that maybe this is something they should sit down and look at the evidence for all across the world.
and working together.
Yeah,
definitely. That. I think that's one of the key points that you were saying there. Do you mean everybody coming and working together? Mm-hmm. I think that helps improve people's lives, and for Scotland more so, helps reduce drug deaths.
Thank you for listening to this episode with Harold. This was part one of a two-part conversation, and part two will be released soon. Harold spoke at our Supporting Change Amplifying Voices conference, and you can watch his presentation on the SDF YouTube channel. If you've enjoyed this episode, please like it, subscribe and share. Thanks for listening. See you next time.